to the fifth case of the day, Bell et al. Versus Daimler Chrysler Corporation. Mr. Thiessen?
Tyson, excuse me.
Thank you, Your Honor. Honorable judges, may it please the court, my name is John Tyson. I'm from Fort Wayne, Indiana, with the law firm of Tyson Bowers & Associates. I'm with Mr. John LaRue from Muncie, Indiana. We represent approximately 200 plaintiffs in this case who have brought claims against the Chrysler Corporation, claiming that they were denied work opportunity rights at Chrysler's plant in Kokomo, Indiana, after they were laid off from their jobs in Newcastle, Indiana. They bring a hybrid claim under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act, claiming that Chrysler breached the contract and that the union violated its duty of fair representation. We brought this appeal because the district court granted summary judgment against our clients, finding that they failed to exhaust their internal union remedies by not proceeding with internal union remedies with respect to this grievance that was withdrawn without precedent. And we feel that the district court erred in granting summary judgment on that issue. It's our position that we clearly, in the submissions to the trial court, demonstrated that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the grievance, which was withdrawn without precedent, that's the terminology that the union uses here, whether that could be reinstated, because under Clayton, the exhaustion is required if we, either the union can give complete relief or if the grievance could be reinstated. It's our position that the contract, in effect, clearly provided that it could not be reinstated. Your Honor, we submit that the following facts are basically undisputed and were undisputed before the trial court. Fact undisputed number one is the grievance was withdrawn without precedent. I think in the district court's analysis, it uses the term without prejudice, but I think that's just an oversight or a typographical error. But in any event, the first undisputed fact is the grievance is withdrawn without precedent. Nobody disputes that. Chrysler doesn't dispute it. We don't dispute it. Secondly, the internal union appeals procedure does not provide our clients with complete relief. I think everybody agrees on that. The third point, and that the fact that's undisputed, is the master agreement, which was in evidence before the trial court, no dispute, that was the one that controlled the particular time period, February of 2003, when this grievance was withdrawn. It specifically says that if the grievance is withdrawn without precedent, it cannot be reinstated. Now, what happens here is, in the reply brief, Chrysler brings forth this letter 7 that's in his supplemental book of letters, and they take the position that it says the grievance can be reinstated. Well, we dispute that, but that's not really in the record before the trial court, because at that point in time, we say, we don't think we even really need to address it by way of a surreply brief or whatever, because we've already clearly established that, in our minds, we've already clearly established that there is a direct conflict in the evidence that cannot be resolved by way of summary judgment, and that the district court will say, this is a clear conflict in the evidence. It couldn't be any clearer because it's in black and white, the contract, and therefore we're going to have the trier of fact make a determination as to which one of these letters control. Is it letter 7 or is it the master agreement? Because according to Chrysler and according to us, they're diametrically opposed. The district court specifically found that, and they said, we, the plaintiffs, disregarded letter 7. Well, we did disregard it, quite frankly, because we didn't know about it. We saw a master agreement that said, this is it. But even accepting that we disregarded it, once the Chrysler presents it, there's this clear conflict in the evidence, which the district court in its decision completely ignores. The district court says this letter is disregarded, but at the same time, the district court disregards the specific express language of the master agreement, which says it cannot be reinstated. The district court also based its decision on the fact that it said one of the international officials, Pete Cutway, gave uncontradicted testimony that the grievance could be reinstated. Yeah, he gave testimony that it could be reinstated, but wasn't uncontradicted. In our response brief, we said, Your Honor, with all due respect, when we took his deposition, he said that. He said it was in the master agreement. But, Your Honor, here's what the master agreement says, and it says exactly the opposite. So that in and of itself contradicts his testimony. First of all, Mr. Cutway was incorrect in his testimony, and we demonstrated that conclusively with an undisputed document that was in evidence. Now, Your Honors, there's a lot of argument in the various briefs about what the plaintiffs, our clients, should be charged with in terms of knowledge. And we're not sitting here suggesting to the court in any way that union members don't have an affirmative duty to make themselves aware of what's in the contracts. I think the case law is clear, and there's good, solid reasoning for that. We're not suggesting any change there. But we are suggesting that along those lines, if the district court is going to charge our clients with the knowledge of what's in the contract that hurts them, that hurts their position, this letter 7, the district court ought to, at the same time, charge our clients with knowledge of the parts of the agreement that help them, the master agreement, which says it can't be reinstated. You know, I think we all recognize that as a practical matter, none of these union members look at these things or know about it, and quite frankly, that's what happened here. But we have to charge them with knowledge of it, and if we're going to do that, they get charged with the good along with the bad. That's our position.
Your Honor, do you agree there's an ambiguity between letter 7 and letter agreement number 7 and the master agreement?
Oh, it's more than an ambiguity. It's a direct conflict, and a direct conflict with Mr. Cutway's testimony. The court, and we've cited a couple cases in our brief where this court has said in the Folk case and in the Lewis case that when we're looking at this exhaustion requirement, what the court must look to is the reasonableness of imposing the exhaustion under the circumstances. And we think, in light of these undisputed facts, and quite frankly, the other facts about what knowledge our clients had about this book of letters that wasn't generally available where this letter 7 existed and the master agreement which generally was, and court shouldn't impose it under these circumstances, but in any event, the trier of fact should at least be allowed to decide which one of these is applicable, which one controls. Now, if you look at this letter, you know, and it's not in anybody's record because it all came up at the very end. The very end of letter 7, I think it's the second to last paragraph, it says it doesn't apply to portions of the master agreement, to call it the national agreement, we call it the master agreement. It says it doesn't apply to portions of it and affect provisions relating to grievance resolutions under the national agreement. So we think if we go down back to the district court and have a hearing on deciding this conflict, we're going to present that and say, by its very language, it says it doesn't even apply. But, you know, it's sort of unfair for us to address this with this court, and it wasn't addressed at the trial court either because we were convinced that based on what we had presented, we had a issue of fact.
How do we factor in the alternative ground that statute of limitations on the plan a long time ago? I mean, there were discussions of the hiring at the Kokomo plant going quite a few years. Why weren't the plaintiffs on notice of the nature of their claim long before Mr. Lowe was reinstated pursuant?
Your Honor, first of all, the judge, I think, indicated that there was a compelling argument there, but he never got to that issue. But accepting what the defense Chrysler says here, and we do, and we did in our brief, yeah, there was all kinds of problems going on back then with people finding out that people were getting hired at Chrysler, at Kokomo, excuse me, 700 and some, while people were, just as many were laid off at Newcastle. And, yes, they met with the union, and they created a video, and there was a letter-writing campaign. What they didn't know about was that they had work opportunities there. Now, our position on the statute of limitations is when does the cause of action accrue? The cause of action accrues when they know of the breach of contract or should know. And secondly, the second element is when do the union members find out the union breached its duty of fair representation? And it's our position. They go to the union then and say, you've got to do something about this, not because they knew they had recall rights, but because they just knew that people were getting hired. To equate one to the other is unfair to our clients.
But that activity was occurring in the 80s and early 90s.
Yes, yes, it was.
So if statute accrues then, statute of limitations argument is...
They don't know. When the union's telling them there's nothing we can do, the union is intentionally misleading them. There was something the union can do. All this time, all the union had to do is say, you had recall rights, let's file a grievance. They never did that. They specifically told these people, yes, we know people are getting hired there, but there's nothing you can do about it. They said, fine.
So that's when the cause of action accrues. That's when they're on notice that their union isn't doing anything for them. So under any definition of the discovery rule, that's when the clock starts running,
but
right?
If they, as long as they have some knowledge that there's something that the union could do.
Well, the union doesn't have to advise them of that. I think they have to be charged with the knowledge of what to do for them. And if the union has told them, we're not going to do anything for you, that's when the clock starts to run duty of unfair representation claim.
Your Honor, I fully recognize that there are issues in the statute of limitations, but I think the court has also broad-brushed all plaintiffs with this. And
so you acknowledge some plaintiffs might fall out.
Well, I don't think there's any question about it. Some of our plaintiffs are going to fall out. But other ones who'd been laid off in 79 and didn't have any recall rights in 84 or weren't contacted, they weren't even union members anymore.
Well, it's not an actual knowledge standard, though. It's a objectively reasonable union member in this position. So the actual knowledge of the individual defendants doesn't matter. We could say on this record, as a matter of law, as an alternative ground, there was constructive knowledge for purposes of the discovery rule back when all of this letter writing and union meetings and agitation was going on in the 80s and 90s. That's when the clock started.
I don't disagree that I think some individuals are going to have that problem. I think other individuals are going to say, I didn't have this knowledge. And whether they get charged with the knowledge that somebody else has when they might have moved 100 miles away, I don't accept that, no. But I understand Your Honor's position.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Mr. Paul?
May it please the Court, Your Honor, allow me to jump right into the exhaustion requirement, since that's the basis on which Judge Tinder disposed of this case. Exhaustion is required where an intra-union appeal can result in the reactivation of the grievance. And in this case, under Letter Agreement 7, an intra-union appeal could have resulted in the reactivation of the plaintiff's grievance. Letter Agreement 7 was uncontradicted below, as was the affidavit that introduced Letter Agreement 7. Indeed, the plaintiffs made no argument on Letter Agreement whatsoever below. Letter Agreement 7 operates exactly the way the work opportunity letters work. They rely on the work opportunity letters to establish their claim. Well, under the national agreement, it says you have recall rights, but your recall rights are limited to your labor market area. The letter agreements, however, change that. They say, no, your work opportunity rights will be throughout the state of Indiana. So they can't have it both ways. They can't rely on these letter agreements, on the one hand, to establish their claim and say, Chrysler, you're bound by these letter agreements for that purpose, but then say, we're not bound by the letter agreement for purposes of our exhaustion requirement. They can't have it both ways.
Does the record tell us what employees are told about the existence of letter agreements and where to find them? I mean, I gather that not all of these agreements were attached to the master agreement the plaintiffs had in their position.
Well, not directly.
That's kind of unfair, isn't it?
Well, it's not. In fact, even union misinformation about one's intra-union appeals rights is not enough to excuse someone from the exhaustion requirement. These documents are freely available. There's all kinds of evidence that their union officials had access to these documents. The grievance that they filed cites three letter agreements, two of which are in the same book of letters as Letter Agreement 7. Their complaint, attached to their complaint, were several letter agreements. The first complaint in this case was filed 2 weeks after it came out that their grievance had been withdrawn, which was still within the time to file an intra-union appeal. These letter agreements that were attached to their complaint were from the same time period as Letter Agreement 7. So if they knew about letter agreement, these letter agreements when they filed their complaint on February 18, why didn't they know about them on February 4th when it came out that their grievance had been withdrawn?
That's why I'm asking you if the record tells us what employers are told about the existence.
Not directly, Your Honor. But again, there's all kinds of evidence the plaintiffs knew. As to the work opportunity letters, for example, there was a newspaper article printed in the Newcastle Times, which is in the record, which talks about the Indiana work opportunity agreement. There are these letter writing campaigns that we discuss in our briefs. And in those letter writing campaigns from the mid-80s and the mid-90s, they talk about work opportunity rights, recall rights, 45-day letters. Where are they getting this language from? They're getting it from these letter agreements. They know these letter agreements are around. Plus, the national agreement itself, the 99 national agreement, refers to these letter agreements. They rely on Section 115 to say, well, letter agreements can't apply because they somehow contradict the agreement or they're outside the national agreement. Well, the very provision they rely on to say that references letter agreements. Everyone knows that these letter agreements are out there. It's no secret. They also submitted some evidence from one of the union officials who was a recording secretary through the mid-1980s. His affidavit was offered to authenticate these books of letters. This is their evidence. There's a 91 grievance that they submitted into the record about a work opportunity violation. It references the book of letters. This grievance was filed by their local union. And there is other evidence that they knew or, and this is the standard, should have known about their rights. They had every opportunity to know what their rights were. Plus, there's no evidence of diligence here. There's no evidence that they asked what their intra-union appeal rights were, or that if they did ask, that they were refused, or that they were told misinformation. There's none of that sort of evidence. The bottom line is that ignorance is no excuse, even as to letter agreements. This court has applied letter agreements before. In Miller versus GM, I think it's a 1982 case, the court in that case did not quote the letter agreement, but the description of the letter agreement that the court gives in that case sounds very similar to the letter agreement that is at issue here. And the court in that case applied the letter agreement and said to the plaintiff, you didn't exhaust your intra-union appeal rights. You could have had your grievance reinstated had you done so. I'm sorry, but your claim is barred. So these things are not familiar to the plaintiffs, nor are they familiar to this court. Let me briefly address their futility argument. Only the Bell plaintiffs make this argument, and the sole basis on which they make this argument is a statement by a union official named General Hollyfield, who said shortly before it came out that their grievance had been withdrawn, that the matter was a dead issue. Well, there are a couple of problems with this argument. The first is that it rests on a false premise. They say General Hollyfield is the president of the International Union, and, well, if he said it, what was the point of filing an intra-union appeal? If he said it's dead, it would have been fruitless. Well, in point of fact, he is not the president of the International Union. He's never been the president of the International Union. But more importantly, this doesn't begin to demonstrate the level of hostility that is required to show futility. It must be so pervasive, the hostility, that it infects every step of the intra-union appellate procedure. This statement doesn't impugn the integrity of the International Executive Board, the Public Review Board, the Constitutional Convention Appeals Committee, any one of which could have reinstated this grievance. Indeed, even if General Hollyfield were on one of these boards, the presence of one potentially hostile member is not enough to show futility. Nor does this statement by General Hollyfield impugn the integrity of the appeal board where this grievance would have gone back to had it been reinstated. The man who handled the grievance at the appeal board step took his job very seriously. This is Paul Cutway. He said in his deposition, if I could put Humpty Dumpty back together again and go out and get these people justice, I would have done it. But he felt like the grievance was too little, too late. So, and we also have to remember, Your Honors, the standard of review. Nowhere in their briefs do they acknowledge that the standard of review on this ignorance issue and this futility issue is abuse of discretion. And Arnold, this Court's case in Arnold, makes that extremely clear. Abuse of discretion is the proper standard of review. So, in conclusion, plaintiffs could have exhausted. They didn't, and Judge Tinder did not abuse his discretion, refusing to excuse them from the exhaustion requirement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Mr. Tyson, your time has expired. You may have a minute if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the exhaustion requirement, the only thing that we would suggest is any reasonable person, you know, they talk about the knowledge they should have known about the Book of Letters. Let's assume they did. Any reasonable person looking at the master agreement and letter 7 would think that a grievance withdrawn without precedent could not be reinstated. At least the inference is there. There's at least a material issue of fact. I think reasonable lawyers looking at it are confused about it. But my people have said they didn't know about this Book of Letters, but charge them with the knowledge of it. There's still an issue of fact there that needs to be resolved. Thank you.
Thank you, Tyson. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the sixth and final case of the day.